Good morning. Welcome back to the Broadcast Retirement Network. This is BRN Weekly for Saturday, March 2nd, 2024. And our top story today, the NASDAQ soars to a new high, but inflation continues to rise. And joining me now to discuss this and a lot more, Jane King is a financial journalist joining us from the NASDAQ. And Jeffrey Kleintop is the chief global investment strategist for Charles Schwab. Jeff, great to see you. Great to meet you. Jane, always welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Jeffrey.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And it's great to have another like-minded Jeff and someone with a great haircut. Jane, you have a great haircut as well. In fact, I'm jealous. But Jane, let's start off the NASDAQ soaring to some new highs this week. I want to get you're right there. I mean, you're at the NASDAQ, so I'm sure you were kind of pushing things up. How did we do this week?
Yeah, well, it was a first record high for the NASDAQ close since 2021, and I think we can thank AI for that. I mean, what a phenomenon this has been, and with NVIDIA's earnings last week, you wonder, like, can this company continue? I mean, despite all the momentum that it's had, continue to beat expectations, and they did it last week. And, brought along a lot of the hyperscalers, the other AI and the other chip companies along with it. And so we saw the S&P hit new records. And then yesterday was the NASDAQ's turn.
Yeah, I'm going to say I'm not really Jeff Snyder. I'm really artificial intelligence. In fact, you don't need artificial intelligence for that. Jeff, I want to come to you because I want to pull back a little bit. Let's talk about your thoughts about the global picture. This cardboard box, are we looking at a recession? Are we not looking at a recession? How do you take all the data that we've gotten and kind of put it into a usable format?
Yeah, it's fascinating because part of the world has been in a recession in the second half of 2023. Jane just talked about the NASDAQ hitting new highs. We had the Stoxx 600 index in Europe hit new highs in February. We had the Nikkei 225 Japan's index hit new highs last week in the past week here for the first time in 34 years as well. They're doing it without AI. So what's going on? Well, one of the things I've noticed is that we have been in a manufacturing recession. I've been calling it a cardboard box recession because, things we manufacture tend to go in cardboard boxes. And demand for corrugated fiberboard, the thing we make cardboard boxes out of, was in a recession. Demand was down 10, 15% like we usually see in a global recession. But that has turned around. We've actually seen a rebound in demand for cardboard boxes along with improving manufacturing sentiment. In fact, we're getting the global manufacturing PMI today. That should show maybe a second month in a row of a 50.0 reading, meaning we're finally at the threshold between expansion and contraction in manufacturing. That's after 16 months of negative numbers there in manufacturing. So that's turning around. Manufacturing isn't the biggest portion of employment or the economy, but it does matter a lot for earnings. And that's a brighter picture there for earnings. One of the reasons why Japanese and European stocks are joining U.S. tech stocks in hitting new all-time highs.
Yeah, and Jeff, I want to just follow up. Let's talk a little bit about some of the risks, the global supply chain risks. I think you talked about some. I use cardboard boxes. We just moved to our new apartment, so we were using cardboard boxes. I do recall, by the way, paying a little bit more to do that as I was packing for the move. But let's talk about some of the global supply chain risks that you and Charles Schwab see right now.
So one of the biggest risks, I think, in inflation, and we saw that in yesterday's European inflation data for Germany, and we saw it actually this morning in the overall European CPI numbers, transportation costs are going up. One of the biggest challenges right now is we've got this, both the Suez Canal and Panama Canals are effectively shut down. These are two of the biggest shortcuts to moving the world's goods, right? You don't have to go around Africa necessarily to get goods from Asia to Europe. You don't want to have to go through South America or all the way around South America to move things from the Pacific to the Atlantic. But we're having to do that right now. And that is really pushing up costs. It's actually creating even a shortage of container ships, containers themselves, those big metal shipping containers that we put on container ships. And that's pushed up prices quite a bit. Fortunately, they appear to be peaking out. We're probably experiencing the worst of those shortages right now. There's about an 800,000 container shortfall in China right now as they get back to work after the Chinese New Year, trying to ship all those products out to the rest of the world. So that is pushing up costs. It is one of the risks to inflation and one of the concerns we have about central banks and when they might begin cutting rates. There's this risk that inflation might remain a little bit higher for a little bit longer because of those transport costs.
And Jane, I want to bring you back into the inflation conversation because inflation here in the States, a little bit elevated. And, you know, wondering what you're hearing with regard to our central bank, better known as the Federal Reserve, in terms of what they're going to do with their rate decision. I know it was a kind of iffy the last couple of weeks. We were talking with different experts like Jeff about their decision. But how, what are you hearing?
Yeah, well, both, you know, the CPI and the PPI came in hotter than expected, the most recent numbers that we got. But then the PCE number that we got this week was exactly as expected. And stocks had a relief rally on that. That was another thing that drove the NASDAQ to the record high, in addition to the AI and all the excitement about that. So I'm definitely hearing the Federal Reserve probably won't make any cuts to interest rates and through March or May. And then after that, you know, we'll see. We'll see what the data says. We're getting closer to a presidential election. They may choose to just sit on the sidelines and see. But it's kind of, we've saw a crypto rally this week as well. Maybe that also plays into the inflation. I mean, Bitcoin back near record highs, and it's been another interesting market to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jeff, I want to come to you. I can't let you leave, Jeff, without talking about the international stock markets, maybe in particular, Japan. That one seems like an interesting one to me.
I'm so excited about what's going on in Japan. It's been a long time coming. We've seen this transition to international leadership actually since the bear market ended back in October of 2022. Since then, Japanese stocks, in fact, international stocks overall have been outperforming the U.S. It's just hard to see past those high-flying AI stocks in the U.S., but the Nikkei's done really well, and there's several reasons why Japanese stocks are doing well, even without the benefit of some of these high-flying AI stocks. Number one, we're seeing capital flows back into Japan. Maybe Warren Buffett led the way, but we're seeing much more money moving back towards Japanese markets. Even Japanese investors themselves are beginning to bring money home after 17 years of borrowing money cheaply in Japan and investing overseas. That carry trade, as it's called, is beginning to reverse. At the same time, we've got an improvement in the manufacturing picture. Japan's a big manufacturer. And so we're seeing that begin to pick up a brighter earnings outlook. Valuations in Japan, despite moving the stocks moving a lot higher and up 17% this year, are still in line with their 20-year average. So they're not expensive, whereas stocks in the US, the S&P 500, 32% above their average PE multiple over the last 20 years. So that's a factor. There are other issues involved. You know, the Tokyo Stock Exchange is requiring businesses to be more shareholder friendly, issue more dividends, pay more, do more share buybacks in increasing their price to book ratio and getting that up above one for the first time in a long time. So a lot of things going on. They're really benefiting Japanese equities. I think that's a trend that'll continue this year.
Well, Jane, Jeff, we're going to have to leave it there. Jane, always great to see you. Thanks for the expert analysis. Jeff, great to meet you and have you on the program. We look forward to having both of you back on the program again very soon.
Can't wait.
Thanks, Jeffrey and Jane. Great to see you. Thanks for sharing your perspective. And when we come back, we'll take a look at some of our best segments for the week. You're going to want to stay tuned right here on BRN Weekly.
Imagine a new television network that will make you richer, healthier, and in control of your financial future. This network is for the policewoman in Nashville, Tennessee, the baker in Dubuque, Iowa, the teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. We want to make the idea of savings and retirement culturally relevant. But what do you see as a defining issue of the midterms? Especially for the smaller businesses, I mean, they are the lifeblood of the American economy. Featuring exclusive interviews, current affairs, and docuseries. 33 years old, you retired early.
The philosophy is money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love.
But you gotta start thinking about retirement as soon as you get in.
The Broadcast Retirement Network will drive very high engagement with premium partnerships. So this isn't retirement and savings for your parents or grandparents. This is for all Americans. And we're gonna change the way you think about money. Welcome to the next frontier of retirement and savings. This is BRN, the Broadcast Retirement Network.
Welcome back. Well, it was a great week of great shows, great topics, and of course, great guests. We kicked off the week with a look at the link between housing and cancer mortality for homeless veterans. Let's take a look.
We know that the federal government has made ending and addressing veteran homelessness a priority since 2009. And what we really have seen over the past decade plus since that time is a marked reduction in veteran homelessness overall. There's actually been a 45% reduction in veteran homelessness, which far outpaces the changes in the general U.S. population, where the unhoused population has actually been increasing, especially in certain parts of the country. And so we have seen that veteran homelessness, while a big issue, is something that the government has been tackling in part through the VA. And then in terms of how homelessness affects health, there is a wealth of studies that have shown that being unhoused affects nearly every single aspect of health. Unhoused people have higher rates of chronic diseases like heart disease and cancer, which are two of the leading causes of death in older unhoused adults. They have higher rates of traumatic injuries, have higher rates of substance use disorders, and all of this culminates in markedly premature rates of mortality for unhoused people compared to the general population. So when we talk about how housing impacts health, it really impacts every single element of, of people's lives and their health outcomes. And we can see that in premature mortality. So the study that we did was really trying to answer the following question: does gaining housing in the year after cancer diagnosis, is that associated with better outcomes than remaining homeless? And there have been studies in other realms that have looked at the health impacts of gaining housing, but it hasn't been studied before in cancer. And we thought that it was important to study it in cancer because a few reasons. One, cancer is a leading cause of death, like I said, in older unhoused adults. Two, the unhoused population in this country is aging. So at this time, nearly half of all of the unhoused single adults are actually aged 50 years or older. And that's the age at which cancer incidence increases, and also screening recommendations start to kick in, where we start to recommend screening for certain cancers. And so we really wanted to see, the last thing is that we know that cancer treatment is very complicated in today's day and age. It's multidisciplinary. It takes inputs from medical oncologists, surgical oncologists, radiation oncologists, social workers, and all different people who touch many different parts of the healthcare system. And so we wondered, does gaining housing help facilitate some of that care and help contribute to better outcomes overall? What we did is we looked at about a decade of cancer diagnoses at the VA. And what we were able to do is ascertain people's housing status. So were they unhoused at the time of diagnosis, or were they housed at the time of diagnosis? And then in the year afterwards, did that housing status change? Did people gain housing or did people lose housing? What we found, we had a sample of over 100,000 veterans, so a very large sample. We found is that just about 5% of veterans were actually unhoused at the time of cancer diagnosis. And of that group, 20% actually gained housing and were housed in the year following diagnosis. And when we compared outcomes between those groups, what we found, which I think is not surprising, is that the unhoused veterans had worse survival overall after diagnosis with lung and colorectal cancer specifically. But the veterans who gained housing in the year afterwards, they actually had really improved survival that was in fact about equal to veterans who were housed for the entire period of time. So we found that to be pretty interesting and pretty exciting, actually. We know housing exists on a spectrum, that there's high quality housing and then there's low quality housing. And then that goes on and on and on to living in a shelter, living in a tent on the street, being unsheltered. And so it's very hard to actually determine where along that spectrum people fall. And one of the reasons is because in large administrative data sets, like, through hospital systems or other kind of health systems, really, we don't do a very good job of documenting housing status. And we definitely don't do it with the level of granularity that I think you're alluding to that we really need to know. But the VA, in contrast to that, really does a great job of documenting housing status, which sort of goes hand in hand with this federal effort to address and end veteran homelessness. Because to do that, you have to be able to identify it. So through the VA electronic health record, there are multiple places where housing status is documented. And we were able to cobble together all of those different sources from diagnosis codes to housing registries and all of that to say, well, who really is unhoused and who is housed? And the way we were able to tell how that changed over time was because the VA periodically screens veterans and asks them, do you have stable housing? And so a lot of it is actually self-reported and what a veteran considers to be stable housing. But for the most part, living, you know, in a vehicle that's not really suitable for or wasn't designed to be, you know, a living situation, living in a tent, living outside, living in a shelter, all of those we would consider to be unhoused based on the federal government's definition of being unhoused.
Next up, we discuss mortgage rates and the impact on the home buying market this spring. Let's take a look.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, February, we've seen rates go up just due to a pretty strong headline jobs number. And then, of course, two inflation reports that came in a little bit to the upside. So that's all given, you know, the markets and analysts a little bit of trepidation about when and if the Fed's going to lower, as they said. So in November, Jerome Powell came out and said that he sees rate cuts in the future. Mortgage rates improved and everyone was happy for about 2.5 months. And then these numbers came out. So, but I think if you dig down deep into the minutia of those reports, you can find some evidence to think that the support effect, maybe this isn't, maybe it is a little temporary, a little transitory, and the Fed still has some ammunition to cut rates. Maybe not, you know, early Q2, maybe later Q2 or early Q3. Usually the bond market, which is what affects rates, treasuries, is ahead. So typically when you see the Fed lower or raise rates, it's already built in. You don't see much of a reaction. It's when you get that surprise, as we've had again in February, you know, the headline jobs number early February for the January report, the headline number was higher than most were anticipating. But again, when you look down at U6 and some of the other things that are going on there, and the fact that a lot of it was government jobs, I think you can make the case that maybe that report wasn't quite as robust as a lot of people originally thought. But then literally a week later, you had the CPI came out, and that was not a lot higher, but a little bit. And then PPI came out last Friday, the Friday of that same week. And that one was, I think, 0.5% higher than expected. But if you look at like the Philly and the Fed and the Richmond manufacturing, Fed manufacturing indices, both of those are showing recessionary warning signs. And when you look at the jobs report, that's more of I guess what you call a trailing indicator. But when you look at the Fed manufacturing numbers, those are more of a leading indicator. So I do think that at some point this year, the Fed's going to have to do something. And I'm not really as focused on how many cuts, but really the totality of cuts. So if they cut three times and it's 150 basis points or six times, it's only a quarter point. I think we have to look at that right now. So again, Powell's language is going to be what everyone's looking at. But to answer your question, yeah, I don't think that typically when the Fed raises or lower rates, it's going to affect prime credit cards. It's not really going to affect mortgage rates. It's kind of already anticipated. I mean, for us, late January, early February, we actually had up for probably about 14 months, record amount of applications and volume. I think that when people think rates are going to come down, they react, but there's another school of thought where it's like, oh, they're going to keep coming down, right? And they continue to wait. I would still advocate for people that I think, I'm not a gambler, but for me, and I have no crystal ball, but I do think rates are going to come down. So, I mean, right now, if we fast forward, say, 6 months and the Fed lowers rates and the market anticipates that mortgage rates come down, it stands to reason that you're going to have a lot more competition. More people are going to feel confident. Oh, I can afford it now. And basic supply and demand. If there's more people, prices probably go up. So if rates come down 0.5%, but home values go up 10%, is the payment about the same? Are you paying a little bit more? So, I mean, those are the things that people have to look at. And I think that, and I've said this for 30-something years, there's two things when it comes to buying a house. Obviously, you want to be financially ready. But the other one, and this is the one most people overlook, you need to be emotionally ready too. Are you ready to buy a house? Do you understand? When you rent, It's a nice day. You want to go out to the park with the dogs? No big deal. You own, you have to think, well, I guess I have to mow the lawn first. I got to rake the leaves. I got to weed. I got to, all those other things. So with home ownership comes responsibility. And renting, you don't really have that. So I think when you're emotionally, financially ready, now is probably a good time to at least get pre-approved. There's a lot of, about a third of credit reports have errors on them. So if you have an error, we can fix it. There's a lot of programs out there, grant programs that allow people to buy with no money down. In fact, Maryland has a really cool one. It allows you to buy a house and pay off up to $50,000 in student loan debt at the same time. Each state has their own little nuances of programs like that. But so there's a lot of great programs. But again, I think now's a good time because you never know. Sometimes you're just looking on the computer and something pops up. You're like, oh, this is perfect. But if you're not pre-approved, there's going to be five offers, 20 offers ahead of you, and it's going to be accepted. You're too late to the game. So get pre-approved. There's no urgency there, but at least you know what's going on. And now, if you buy today and rates do drop, you can always refinance. And at that point, it's just you in a queue, right? You're not competing against 15, 20 other buyers. So if you can buy a house today, get the equity, and then lower your rate, yeah, you have closing costs a couple of times, but you're probably still come out ahead of the game if, again, you're emotionally and financially ready to buy.
And that wraps up this episode of BRN Weekly. Have a topic of interest? Someone you think we should talk to? Drop us a line. And don't forget, for all the latest curated news and lifestyle, wellness, finance, tech, so much more in all in one place, check out today's edition of our daily newsletter, The Morning Pulse. Want to search our archives, check out our latest content? Well, then visit our website. Hey, we're back again tomorrow for another edition of BRN Sunday. We'll be joined by the Legal Eagles. That's David Levine, Kevin Walsh of the Groom Law Group to help break down kind of what's going on in Capitol Hill. Definitely a ton to talk about there. And then Oliver Rennick of the Schwab Network will be here to help break down markets, take a look at the economy, and kind of wrap things up in a nice, pretty bow, hopefully. Until then, I'm Jeff Snyder. Stay safe, keep on saving. And don't forget, roll with the changes. Now is your opportunity to co-create content around any topic on the First Lifestyle and Wellness Network. Reach a global audience through our platform and co-own exclusive branded content. All of our programs are available on demand and also as audio-only podcasts, so you can take us on the go. Broadcast Retirement Network, available anytime, anywhere, and on any device.